All right. Well, hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. My name is Greg Rogers with Neuro, but I do not represent Neuro on their podcast or their views. And I'm joined by my lovely co-host, whose hair looks fantastic this morning.
Pete Gould. Thank you. I'm a senior vice president with Boundary Stone Partners. And again, here, views are our own. And I'm joined by my equally lovely, though not on video, co-host, Greg Rodriguez.
Hey, everybody. It's Greg Rodriguez, mobility policy principal with Stantec. And like everyone else, views are our own.
Awesome. Well, it's really great to be back. You know, we took off a few months this summer to spend more time with our families, standard sort of political excuse. But we're really excited to be back in the saddle, starting to record a ton of great new episodes. There's a ton going on this year. And we also recently celebrated our fourth anniversary or a birthday. Happy birthday or what should we call it? Is it a birthday?
It's an anniversary.
An anniversary.
What is the fourth anniversary? Something diamonds or something special, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Pete,
you'll learn about that.
Yeah. And you know, on that note, I think we all had some fun things happening going on. Pete, anything exciting in your life?
No, sure. No, it's been a year and a half standing inside. So, but yeah. I'm very excited to be back with the podcast crew and awesome. Yes.
Greg, how about you? What's going on?
Same, just working away from home. Little bummed about the Delta variant, but hopefully we come through it after probably another winter lockdown. Congrats to Greg Rogers, though. Married man. Very excited for him. On the other.
Well, I wasn't fishing. Thank you.
Yeah, I was like, we went through this whole thing just for Greg to... We already spoiled the surprise on our last episode, by the way.
Oh, so. Well. Yeah, and that was a really fantastic recording, I thought, with Senator Tammy Duckworth. For anyone who missed that, definitely go back and check it out. It's a really interesting and, I thought, very insightful discussion with the senator about the issue of accessibility and transit. And on the topic of legislation on the Hill this year, I'm actually going to turn it over to our resident Hill expert, Pete Gould. Tell us a little bit about the bipartisan infrastructure package that is definitely been in the news all summer. So Pete, what's going on? First of all, what are we talking about here? What's this package about?
Sure. So, everyone who's in the infrastructure world who's been following this has kind of known, you know, this was going to be a big year in infrastructure policy. Whatever that looked like was always up in the air. You know, there were early conversations with, you know, one group of bipartisan senators in the White House that fell through. I will fully admit I was very much a skeptic from the beginning that, you know, a gang of anything, those gangs almost never work. I was wrong, you know, thus far I was wrong. A gang that was led, first by five Democrats and five Republicans and then expanded out to 10 of each plus a couple extras. Brought together a kind of broader package than just a surface transportation reauthorization bill. It kind of incorporated in the packages that the Senate had already done. The Environment and Public Works Committee had put together through committee, you know, its package on the highway portion of this. The Senate Commerce Committee had done their portion. There was nothing out of banking for where the transit title comes. But they also brought in on the outside things a lot along the lines of airports, ports, broadband, a lot in the energy space. They brought over a bill that was moved in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee chaired by Senator Manchin that looked into a lot of different new technologies, a lot of carbon capture, a lot of research and development and the like. Cats and dogs, things like broadband in rural communities, they got a lot. And so you then move this process through a very arduous kind of trying to keep all sides on board and passed through the Senate, what had been called for a while, and I think I kind of want to still keep it as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, or the BIF. It's now.
It sounds nice. It really rolls off the tongue, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. It you know, and what it is, you know, it's a major piece of legislation. You know, I think that we spent much of this year focused on what we didn't like in it, or what needed to be different, or what was left out. You know, I think now that it has moved and you know, is looking like it's going to be either yes or no on that bill, you know, we're starting to see a lot of what is in there. And it does do a lot of good. You know, is it perfect? Absolutely not. Nothing that gets that many votes in the Senate is ever going to be perfect to anyone. But I think the legislative name now is the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or EJA, or WIJI, or however we're going to pronounce that. Again, BIF. It is it's $550 billion over mostly 5 years bill. It has significantly more funding for highways than what we saw in either the House or Senate bills on reauth. You know, what we have is kind of the reauthorization plus a big chunk of appropriated money. So it is one-time money that goes to both highways. It goes to transit. It goes to ports. It goes to transit, EV transit buses, the LONO program that got $5.25 billion. The school buses, for electric school buses, mostly electric school buses, got $5 billion. EV charging, I think, was a huge winner in this. The president has really emphasized, his goal of 500,000 chargers, deployed over the next, let's say, 10 years. This provided $7.5 billion for that, plus eligibility in a whole bunch of core highway programs, and then port electrification, airport ground transportation electrification, you name it. On the highway side, go ahead. And you're muted.
Great.
It's like 2 years in and we're still learning.
Yeah, on my tombstone will be written, you're muted. I just want to pause on the electrification investments, because I think this is really, really significant. And, the LONO program has been really helpful, I think, for helping to transition, public transit fleets over to electric vehicles over the years. And it's a sizable investment of $5.25 billion. But, one of the recurring sort of memes of this year that I think will go down in, meme history, of course, is what is infrastructure, right? Obviously, the mobility podcast is infrastructure. And obviously, roads and bridges are infrastructure. But there's been the focus on what's human infrastructure? What are the things people need to live? And what are things that will that are necessary for a functioning society, right? And I especially think that the school buses, the electric school buses, that $5 billion investment, and Pete, I think you said it was $2.5 billion for zero emission school buses and $2.5 billion that could be used for zero emissions or low emissions school buses. That's a really significant investment because school buses are the aspect of transportation I think gets ignored way too much, which is really crazy, given that I think there are about 500,000 school buses in the U.S. and the largest fleet, as it were, of buses in the U.S. is school buses. And so we see a lot of negative health impacts from diesel school buses. And I think that just seeing that investment and seeing that attention paid to this area is really cool from a wonk's perspective. One of the things in this past year or two that we've really seen with the pandemic is people starting to think about trips beyond just commuting. There's so much focus in transportation on commuting, but there's so many more important trips that we need to be looking at cleaning up and giving more options in. And I think that, school buses for education and helping people access things in their community is also very important. But Pete, proceed, with that. Let's go to the highways.
Yeah, so I mean, on the highways, and I would say on a lot of, particularly in the transit title too, what we saw was a lot less policy and a lot more money.
Just writing checks.
Yes. And you know, so on the highway side, what we saw was, you know, $110 billion for highways with very few, if any, you know, new strings attached. You know, I know that is, I think, one of the biggest, and I think, you know, correctly, criticisms of the bipartisan package versus what was passed in the House under Chairman DeFazio. The House bill really, I think, dug in more on that more money. You know, we don't have a lack of building infrastructure problem. That is not our climate problem. It really matters how and what you build. And so you don't see a lot of that. And I think that was the product of the process, that the EPW bill was not supposed to be the final product. It was supposed to be the product that would go to a negotiation with the House bill and end up somewhere in the middle. And, you know, and so I think when you're doing this kind of process, particularly when you have a large second, even bigger package that everyone is ready to get to next, a lot of the details and the wonky stuff does fall by the wayside. Yeah. You know, and again, that these are the things we've been focused on these last 6 months is this is crazy. We've got to, you know, blow. But I don't want to undersell how big some of these, the importance of some of the investments that we are going to see. You know, I think on the transit school buses, those are amazing. When you have much, much smaller programs, what you end up having is, you know, you're doing good, but it is impossible to really catalyze a, you know, these whole fleet transitions. You're kind of sprinkling a couple buses here, a couple buses here. And in the early years that was necessary. They were trying these out. You had a new technology, and application that was really, showing itself and also creating itself and fine tuning it. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've gotten to that point now where, you know, if you want to, you know, for a lot of, you know, fleets, I think California has a mandate that everyone's going electric, you know, do not bring a non-electric or zero emission school bus or bus, or eventually car to the state, you know, in the next decade. And so when you have this, you know, this is one of those areas where actually money is policy, because you are able to actually do much more than what you had. And I think school buses, that's a real issue because they had a much smaller pot. I think we're talking, let's say, anywhere from 10 to maybe 100.
DOE's DERA program, right? The diesel emissions reduction.
EPA.
So it's EPA. A tiny, tiny program.
Yeah. And so when you have 100, even 100 million, much less 10 million nationwide, that is, you know, here's two buses here. And it actually incentivizes more of the low emissions, which is, you know, anything from a propane to a, you know, a kind of new fancy diesel, which is better than the very, very, very old diesel, but is not exactly a we're going all in on cutting this. So those are big deals. Go ahead.
I totally agree. And you know, it's hard to even feel that nostalgia for the bus fumes that you that defined our childhood. you know, hopefully, you know, children in the future won't have to deal with that.
First day of school smell is just actually you're not used to having diesel fumes.
Greg.
Just taking a step back, I think my concern with this legislation is that, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of terms being thrown out there, like it's preserving the status quo, right? Yeah, we're having this whole discussion around school buses, but by the time these things are built and rolled out, is that going to even be the means that kids need to get to school, right? I mean, and even before that, we have schools crumbling around us. Mm-hmm. So are those schools going to even be in the same location? So this is where, like, my biggest challenge with the new role I'm in my current work is trying to think about, like, land use and then the implementation side of things. And that's where I think now I very much see the disconnect between how policy and legislation and funding is done versus what's actually happening on the ground. And it seems like the investments we're making, if the infrastructure bill passes, are 5 years too late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that goes to a great point, Greg. And I think that, you know, at the risk of being snarky, you know, it's not about the highways. It's how you use them, right? It's not about the roadways. It's how you use them. And if we're just going to be doing the status quo, right? We know that hasn't worked. You know, creating infrastructure purely for personal automobiles and continuing sort of this auto-centric sort of focus in U.S. transportation isn't going to help us confront our most significant challenges today, our generational challenges, right? A generational reinvestment needs a generational strategy to solve the issues with climate change. Transportation is the number one contributor, greenhouse gas emissions, rising pedestrian and bike fatalities, and obviously, you know, traffic choke roads where we're seeing our supply chains being strained. And I think that you're right. Overall, what we need is a wholesale rethinking of how we're actually using our streets. And, you know, on point was just with schools, right? You know, you think about the Safe Routes to School program, which is focused on making it safer for kids to walk and bike to school. How can we look at doing those things too, and making greater investments in active transportation? I think is really a huge question that deserves more attention here.
Well, on that point, and I completely agree. I mean, I what's always so difficult on this is, like, especially when you ever talk about shovel ready project, that what that means is that is a project that was conceived of probably 20 years ago. Right. I think what is key is that our frustration here is that we see the way that states, particularly state DOTs, have used their funding. Mm-hmm. You know, when there is nothing in this bill that forces or, like, makes it more difficult for a, you know, or that makes it less difficult for a state to, like, have to do terrible projects. You know, I think we're almost taking away the agency of state departments of transportation to use this money, which is 100% eligible to do really good things, and to use it for good things. You know, that, like, just because I didn't force you and, like, itemize every, you know, the big complaint always from state DOTs and from kind of the infrastructure kind of community is that there's, you know, too many federal strings and not enough money. Mm-hmm. But most of those strings are what we are talking about are trying to, like, force people to just stop widening highways through, you know, through the middle of downtown and just stop pretending that you solve congestion by widening the highway. We're taking away responsibility and like agency from these departments that, like, they have the responsibility and that, like, there needs to be, I think, not just a wholesale at the federal level, because the way the program works is almost is that the state DOTs really do pick what happens here. I mean, the sad irony of this is even the big things that became points of contention and then eventually got kicked out of this bill, we're not going to stop state DOTs who are dead set on just being, you know, doing the way they've always done for 50 years. You know, we were trying to get them to, like, come up with a modeled greenhouse gas emissions thing, and it had no hard strings on it, and that got big pushback. Yeah. So, like, at some point, you know, what would be a transformational, you know, federal transportation bill on that front, we're still just kind of tweaking around the edges of, like, just say climate change,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
When, like, the responsibility is on a state DOT, on an MPO, on the people who are actually implementing this. And so I think that, you know, that is, and you can see the difference in a lot of the city DOTs who are increasingly getting and doing good things with the same, you know, with these pots of money. And so there is nothing that is, you know, the structure of the program does not force you to do terrible things if you don't want to do terrible, like, infrastructure. So I think that, you know, on the implementation side, having accountability within the state DOTs, I also think there's getting good engineers that want to do this kind of good thing, getting good planners, you know, a generational change, you know, kind of turnover at DOTs, at the state level, at the city level, at the, you know, regional level. We have to ensure that the kind of onboarding and transfer of power does not include a transfer of mindset.
Yeah. Yep. Amen.
And I think that is where long-term big changes start to come. And I think, you know, again, would it be nice to make a program that makes it impossible to do terrible projects? Yes. I think that's very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, like, you look at NEPA and it's like, if you know, we're joking. If they want to build a terrible project and they still have to go through NEPA and they can, you know, you come up with an alternatives analysis and you can just make it so that the only alternative that makes sense is the terrible project, because they can game a system if they want it, and it just takes longer and costs more, and then they still do a terrible project. So I do think there has to be more accountability, and this is where it gets tough on the politics of it, because people run for governor and they say, I'm going to fix traffic. What does that mean? I'm going to widen highway, whatever.
Yeah. Because it's the 4-year mentality, right? Of you open your new highway, you expand it, and induced demand takes a little bit to catch up, but.
Yeah. It's a much more complicated conversation than I'm going to widen the highway and this guy doesn't want to fix traffic.
It doesn't make for a good soundbite. And, this kind of hits to something that, I'm going to channel Beth Osborne here, but, and for anyone who missed that episode, that was a really fantastic one night, where she was, gave us a lot of good insights into how federal money can be spent today and how it should be spent. But, you look at project reviews that have to be done by transit agencies, even though, a transit project might reduce greenhouse gas emissions, probably more than a highway, they still have more intense and lengthy processes for environmental reviews, even if they'll deliver better outcomes, which is just a crazy sort of, I think, dichotomy between how we do our highway programs versus our transit programs. I think that was something that, Chairman DeFazio tried to fix in his House bill, but unfortunately, as you said, Pete, couldn't survive the politics of the Senate.
Yeah, no, and it's a shame that there wasn't a little bit more of a, what can we take that's really good from the House bill and incorporate it in. And again, I think it was just a power dynamics and a process issue.
Yeah. Let's turn to, there are some innovation programs in there as well, Pete, right?
Yeah. So, this was one area where, we kind of couldn't tell where it was going to come out. The House bill, HR 2 in last Congress, and then also the House bill this time had a very strong emphasis on kind of almost, yes, we'll allow some of these new innovative things, but we're really going to kind of rein in all out and provide multiple layers of here's what the different checklists and kind of defines. Here's innovation, and here are the things that are innovation that I think a lot in, particularly in the AV side, mobility on demand, a lot of that world were concerned with. So, those were not included in. What was included in was a program that was led and has been introduced for several years, led by Senator Catherine Cortez Masto out of Nevada, that is called Nevada. That are called SMART grants, which are Strengthening Mobility and Revolutionizing Transportation Grant, or SMART grant program, which is $100 million a year. And again, provides a lot of flexibility for come to us with innovation. And here are the types of things, but it leaves open. Because I think if the last, let's say, 6 years has shown us anything, we have no idea what's coming in the next 6 years.
Yeah. And just to note on that, because Senator Cortez Masto and her great staff have been, working on this bill for years now. I think that it's a really great effort to try and bring some of that innovation. I think the Smart Cities Challenge had really hoped to do and actually bring some of these ideas onto the ground in more communities, which what I really love is how do we find the right fit for new technologies, and how do we actually solve problems using them? And I think it does a good job of sort of taking a holistic look at that and making sure that those benefits are distributed, are not just realized in urban areas, but also realized in suburban and more rural areas too. And, I think it's that kind of competitive grant program that can really help to make a difference and give communities that flexibility they need to solve problems holistically.
Well, and I also think, the Smart Cities Challenge, which was done in the kind of final years of the Obama administration, Columbus was selected as the sole winner. Yeah. I think they learned a ton from that.
Yeah,
here's the great thing, and therefore technology wins, everybody innovation. We learned a lot about how to do a program like that, but also technologies and what's important in the implementation. Greg Rodriguez, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. I think this, I don't think anyone is going to point to Columbus as either an abject failure or an unbridled, you know, everything was a wild success. I think there's, it was very much a lessons learned up and down the spectrum. So Greg, I don't know if you've got comment on that and what that might mean for us, you know, Smart Grant program or ATC MTD, which is another program in there.
Yeah, no, I think it tracks what you were saying earlier around, you know, some of the perceived or actual restrictions that come with federal funding. I think, you know, that's always a lesson learned whenever a agency, city, state DOT goes and gets federal funding is there's a lot of administration that comes with that federal funding, and you need to be prepared to be able to administer that program and to meet all the reporting requirements. And so it'd be interesting once, you know, that's said and done to see how much money went towards administration versus actual implementation of the dollars. I think the programs you all are talking about, even Pete, you talking about, you know, hopefully this bill empowering more local investment and control of funding, I think that's a good thing. But my fear, again, or concern is that some of the smaller communities that really do need help still aren't going to be able to have that control because it is restricted by population. And then, you know, do they even understand what is possible? And so it'd be interesting, like, that's where I think there's a role for USDOT and more dollars around outreach and education to help inform best practices so that some of these communities that want to do things but just feel very constrained from a resources perspective or don't have a staff like a NYC DOT or LA DOT, like they don't even know where to start and they don't even get the chance to implement some of these ideas that could really help them, especially if they're a rural area or have equity issues or people with disabilities or aging communities, all the things we've been talking about with innovation. I think that's the opportunity. So, you know, I haven't read through the bill the way you have, but I don't know if there is anything in there around, you know, more funding towards outreach and education, development of best practices around some of these things. I think, you know, I'm hopeful. And then the other concern I have is a lot of this, Pete, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, seems like it's going to be discretionary. It's going to be part of, you know, a grant funding application process. And again, that is very competitive and usually requires a lot of resources. So does that leave some communities behind?
Yeah, no, and I think we've heard that a little. I think, but we talked about that with Beth, and I think that is something that the DOT understands because the bipartisan this program and also kind of things we're hearing about coming up in reconciliation too. As hard as this year has been passing this bill, the implementation is going to be a strain. There are a lot of new discretionary grant programs. You know, it used to be Tiger, and now, you know, the Tiger being raised, there is kind of one of many large pots of money. And there has been an emphasis on that, like, if it requires hiring a large consulting agency just to be able to get an application in, then you are self-selecting out a ton of folks. And so what is it that DOT can do? But it just, you know, again, that is that, you know, not only taking on the risk from a financial standpoint to try something new, but what can DOT as a centralized thing, just in making the process and the resources available to communities and getting the outreach out, make it as close to a, you know, it's similar to kind of college applications where you want to make this as easy as possible for as broad of, so that you don't have to have a college admissions coach just to get into, you know, to college. And I think that is definitely an area where USDOT absolutely has to have a role. You know, I think that is a big lesson learned, I think, just even from Tiger. But now the sheer volume of discretionary grant programs, you know, and I also think it for DOT's sanity and functionality purposes to be able to have a system that is easy to understand and easy to do means less hand holding and just trying to navigate tens of thousands of applications that they are going to have to be doing across all of these different programs. But I do also think it opens up huge opportunities for them to be that centralized point of lessons learned of here's how you do this. Here's what this city, you know, this and not even city, this is what this town learned and this region learned. And here's what their dynamics are so that we can be able to like actually get these to be spreading out. And I think, one of the things I think on EV charging in particular, That's going to be an issue. You know, this is not just about let's try something fun and fancy new. Is if we want to do electrification of vehicles, these have to be readily accessible in all communities. It's a lot, you know.
And we have to place them in the right, we have to put them in the right places too, right? Where they'll be utilized, and we have to, there's a lot of strategy that needs to be in, to be involved. So we're not just putting chargers in the middle of nowhere, right? It's and I think that's really important. Although charging them nowhere can be good too.
Yeah, but we also need them. Yeah. But we consider them in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And that's where I think they do set aside, I'm trying to think how much. I want to say it's maybe either 10 or 100 million of the National EV Formula Program, mm-hmm, for city, states, and other applicants that need additional like support. And so I'm hoping that
yeah, there's a Clean Corridors Act, I think was folded in there, which does some strategic sort of corridor building, right?
Well, there's the corridor, but it's also like outside of that formula program, is this is for places where I think it is going to be very hands-on TA and additional support, both financially and implementation. So I think that's good, but I think it applies across all of these programs.
Pete, it scares me when you say 10 million or 100 million, because I think you've been dealing too much in billions. a little bit of a discrepancy there, but anyways, just saying.
I can't imagine
billion or trillion. Yeah.
Does it change how you balance your checkbook, or you just
add a zero, take off a couple, whatever?
Yeah. Hey, so we're about at time here, but that just shows kind of how expansive this package is, and perhaps we can do a bit more of a deep dive later on this fall, especially as things proceed. And
I think to that point, Greg, I think an electric vehicles conversation is very much needed, especially to your point around where to place them. And we're doing a lot of work on whether or not it should be in private right away or on public right away, and where. And so I want to dig more into that once this bill hopefully passes. Let's not jinx it just yet.
Yeah, everyone knock on wood here.
That's a good point. So what is the status of the bill? So the bill is passed in the Senate. The game plan is to never have to involve the Senate again on this bill, because you have a delicate bipartisan agreement over here, and we'll take that whenever we can get it. The House has held off on voting on this because the Speaker and much in the Progressive Caucus have said, we will vote on your bipartisan bill once we have received from the Senate the reconciliation bill, which touches, is going to be a much larger bill and also touches on much more than just physical infrastructure and roads and bridges and the like.
Human infrastructure.
I will personally say, why are we having the argument? What's infrastructure or not?
Yeah.
It's call it whatever you want. Here are things that are important. Yeah. Here are build back better things that are important to this.
Yeah.
That they, there was a whole showdown a couple weeks ago with a number of moderates who said, listen, we're not going to advance the reconciliation bill. So you've kind of got a nice little standoff here. What the compromise there was that they set a date of September 27th. That the speakers agreed that by that is at the latest that they would allow for consideration on the House of the bipartisan bill, which means they have now sped up timelines on the reconciliation bill on both House and Senate to try to get that ready prior to that. And so it's going to be an insane month in following 7 or 8 insane months and then just a year, 5 years. So that is where we are right now. And I think, again, there's not going to be much room, if at all, to let's try to modify the bipartisan bill. The real focus now has turned to what is left out of the bipartisan bill, or what do we want to do in the reconciliation bill, which will be only Democrats, and just has to go through a very crazy and arcane reconciliation process and the Byrd rule in terms of what can and cannot be in. But that's where I think everyone's focus is, because if you change one comma in the bipartisan bill, it's got to go back and get another vote in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think there's not a lot of confidence that we're going to be ping-ponging back and forth. Yep. So and the focus is now on reconciliation.
Yeah, will be a lot of fun. And so stay tuned, everyone, and keep tuning in to the Mobility Podcast. This fall, we'll be bringing a lot more content and a lot more great discussions. To wrap this up real quick, Greg can be found at Smarter Transpo. Pete, you can be found at, what are you now?
I don't know. I'm literally looking at Pete_Gould on Twitter.
Great. And I am Greg Rogers at AV Greg R. Follow the Mobility Podcast at at Mobility Podcast, and check out our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Thanks.